Chapter 5. Juan Cabrillo studied the tactical display on the forward bulkhead of the op center for a few seconds, time he knew he didn't have but needed to take anyway. Three of the four torpedoes fired from the Iranian Kilo-class sub were fanning out and tracking toward their targets, while the sonar showed the fourth had slowed so much that the computer gave only its approximate location. There was less than 2 miles separating the container ship Saga from the first torpedo, while the 200,000-ton supertanker Aggie Johnston had another mile-and-a-half cushion. The third torpedo was coming straight for the Oregon at more than 40 knots. Cabrillo knew the Oregon could take a direct hit, thanks to the reactive armor along her hull that exploded outward when struck by an incoming torpedo and negated the detonative forces, though it would likely damage critical systems. He could also dodge the incoming fish, using the Oregon's superior speed and maneuverability, but the overshooting torpedo then would home in on the Saga as a secondary target and seal her fate. There was simply no way for him to protect the two merchantmen and the Oregon, especially with the reserve torpedo lurking out there. He was dimly aware of Hali Kasim sending a radio alert to the two ships about the inbound torpedoes, not that there was anything they could do. A ship the size of the Aggie Johnston had a pathetically large turning radius and needed 5 miles to stop from her current cruising speed. "I'm tracking two fast movers off the carrier," Mark Murphy said from the weapons stations. "I suspect they're S-3B Vikings, anti-submarine warfare planes armed with either Mark 46 or Mark 50 torpedoes. That Kilo is going to have a real bad day starting in about 10 minutes. "Which is 5 minutes too late for us," Eric said. "Holly, what's the range to the fish tracking us?" Cabrillo asked.
6,000 yards.
"And for the Saga?"
3,200.
Cabrillo straightened in his chair, his decision made. It was time to roll the dice and see what happened. "Helm, increase speed to 40 knots. Put us between the Saga and the torpedo headed for her."
"Aye."
"Webs, open the ports with a forward Gatling and target that fish. Slave your computer to the master sonar plot, and you might need the targeting reticle from the crow's nest camera."
"Just a second," Mark said.
"Mr. Murphy," Juan's tone was sharp, "we don't have a second." Murph wasn't listening. He was engrossed with something taking place on a laptop computer he had jacked into his system.
"Come on, baby, learn it, will you?" he said anxiously.
"What are you doing?" Cabrillo asked, leaning over to compensate for the Oregon's sharp curve through the water.
"Teaching the Whopper a new trick?"
Whopper was what he and Eric Stone called the Oregon's supercomputer, having stolen the name from an old Matthew Broderick movie about a young computer hacker who breaks in to sack NORAD and almost starts a nuclear war.
"We don't need new tricks, Weps. I need that Gatling online and spooled up."
Murph spun around in his seat to look across the room at Max Hanley, who was engrossed with his own computer.
"I don't think this is going to work."
"Keep at it, lad," was all Max said.
"You two mind telling me what's going on?" Juan asked, looking at each man in turn. "Yes, yes, yes, yes," Mark crowed, jumping up from his chair and pumping his fists over his head.
He began typing furiously, not bothering to sit again, his fingers flying over the keyboard, as dexterous as a classical pianist's.
"Logarithms lining up, targeting's coming online. The onboard computer's in sync with ours. I have full control."
"Of what?" Mark glanced at him with a fiendish grin.
"We're about to have ourselves a whale of a time."
Cabrillo blanched and spun to glance at Max. Hanley looked as inscrutable as a Buddha statue.
"You can't be serious," Juan said, but knew his second in command was. "You do know the last time the Russians tried to fire one of those things, it blew a hole in the side of the Kursk and killed all 118 aboard? And this one's an Iranian knockoff, for the love of God." "There's 1,000 yards between the Saga and the Torp," Linda Ross said. With communications swirling among the freighters, the American battle group, and the fast-approaching ASW aircraft, she had taken over the sonar station so Hali Kasim could concentrate on the radios.
"Just giving you an option, Chairman," Max said broadly.
Don't chairman me, you crafty old bastard. Juan studied the tactical display again, noting the Oregon was about to slip between the incoming torpedo and its intended target. Because of the water density, they needed to be directly in front of the torpedo if they were to have any realistic chance of hitting it. By the time they got into position, there would be less than 500 yards between them and the weapon barreling in just 10 feet below the surface. From the camera on the loading derrick, Cabrillo could see the wake line of the incoming torpedo, a faint disturbance in the otherwise tranquil water. It was approaching at better than 40 knots. "Weps, we need to take it before it dives for the keel." "Tracking," Murph said. Eric Stone slid the Oregon into position, using her athwartship thrusters and a heavy blast from the magnetohydrodynamics on full reverse to place them directly in the path of the torpedo. "Permission to fire," Juan said. Mark tapped a few keys. Outside, along the Oregon's flank, the armored plate over the Gatling redoubt slammed open and the six-barrel gun shrieked, a string of foot-long empty shell casings arcing from the mechanism in a continuous blur. A plume of smoke and flame erupted from the ship as a seconds-long burst from the 20-millimeter machine cannon arrowed across the water. Just ahead of the onrushing torpedo, the sea came alive, shredded by hundreds of depleted uranium shells. Gouts of water flew in the air as the slugs bored a hole in the ocean amid a cloud of steam. The Russian-made Test 71 torpedo, packed with over 400 pounds of explosives, roared into the path of the Gatling gun. With enough water forced out of the way by the continuous stream of fire, four of the kinetic rounds hit the weapon dead center. The warhead exploded, sending a series of concussion waves racing across the sea, while, at the epicenter of the blast, a column of water rose 80 feet into the sky before gravity overcame inertia and the entire plume crashed back into the chasm. Though located in the heart of the ship and well insulated from the outside, the crew heard the detonation as though it was thunder crashing directly overhead. Juan immediately turned to Max. "That bought us about 30 seconds. Convince me." "Their torpedoes are all wire-guided. If we can cut them loose, they should go inert. Not even the Iranians would let fish run around in these waters without some sort of control."
"What do you propose?"
"Isn't it obvious? Sink the damned kilo." Juan looked at the tactical display again. He saw the red flashing lights indicating the two inbound American S-3B Vikings, as well as the track lines for the three remaining torpedoes. The reserve fish was beginning to accelerate toward the Oregon, while the primary weapon targeting her had altered course for interception.
"You sure it'll work?" he asked without looking back.
"Course not," Max told him. "It's an Iranian copy of an already flawed Russian weapon. But my crew worked through the night adapting the number one tube so we can fire it, and Murph seems to have the software worked out, so I say go for it. If it works as advertised, it'll take out the three torpedoes long before they reach their targets."
"Murph?"
"Whopper has it pegged, Chairman. I can control it as best as it can be controlled, but it's mostly an aim and hope kind of weapon. At 200 knots, it's pretty damn hard to steer anything."
Cabrillo would either kiss Max and Murph in a few seconds or curse them in hell.
"Helm, turn us bow on to the kilo. Weps, open outer door for tube one. Match bearings and shoot."
Foam creamed off the Oregon's bow as Eric Stone brought the ship around, digging her deep into the waves to give Murph his shot.
"Stoney, another 2 points to starboard," Mark asked, and Eric goosed the thrusters to maneuver the ship so she was pointed directly at where the kilo had fired the spread of torpedoes.
"Linda, she hasn't moved, right?"
"No, she's just sitting there paying out wires to guide her school of fish," Ross replied, and took off the passive sonar headphones she'd been wearing.
That was the last piece of information Mark needed. He keyed the launch control. With a blast of compressed air powerful enough to make the freighter shudder, the modified tube shot the rocket torpedo out through the hull door at nearly 50 knots, fast enough for its specially designed nose cone to create a high-pressure bubble of air around the whole weapon. Just as its onboard computer detected the torpedo was slowing, its rocket kicked on with a deafening roar and its stabilizer fins flicked open. The Hoot, or Whale, rocket torpedo sliced through the ocean in an envelope of supercavitated bubbles that eliminated the deadly drag of having to bull its way through the water. In essence, it was flying and quickly accelerated to 230 knots. Its wake was a boiling cauldron of steam. The image from the topside camera showed that the sea was being ripped apart by a perfectly straight fault line that began at the Oregon's bow and grew at 420 feet per second.
"Look at that mother go!" someone exclaimed.
"Range to target," Juan called.
3,000 yards, Linda said. "Make that 2,600, 2,200, 2,000 yards.
"Mr. Murphy, be ready with the auto-destruct," Juan ordered.
"You don't want to sink the Kilo?
And cause a bigger international incident than we're already looking at? No, thank you. I just want to ring their bell a little bit and cut the guide wires spooling out of the sub's bow."
"How close?"
Juan checked the tactical display, gauging distances between the torpedoes targeting the Aggie Johnston and the Oregon and the ships themselves. The Johnston was less than 30 seconds from having her hull split open by a direct hit. He watched the line of the rocket torpedo cutting across the flat panel, moving so fast that the computer needed to recycle the image every second. He had to make sure to damage the Kilo enough so she couldn't fire another spread, but not to so cripple her that she sank.
1,000 yards, Chairman,
Linda called out, although Juan could see the numbers on the screen blurring backward for himself. There was less than 200 yards now separating the Johnston from the torpedo hunting her. The vectors and speeds involved were complex, but Juan had a handle on it all.
"Wait for it," he said.
If he detonated the rocket too early, there was a chance it wouldn't cut all the wire. Too late, and the Kilo's crew of 53 were going to die.
"Wait for it," he repeated, watching the Hoot arrow through the sea and a faint line of disturbed water approaching the supertanker's exposed flank.
One torpedo was 50 yards from its target, the other 300, but their relative speeds were so vastly different that they would reach their objectives at precisely the same instant.
"Now!"
Mark hit the button that sent an auto-destruct signal to the torpedo's onboard computer. The warhead and remaining solid rocket fuel blew a fraction of a second later, sending an erupting geyser of water into the air and opening a hole in the sea that was 50 feet deep and equally as wide. A stunning concussion wave radiated from the explosion. It hit the Oregon bow on, but hammered the side of the Aggie Johnston so that the massive ship heeled slightly to port. With the explosion's acoustical onslaught reverberating through the sea, it made passive sonar signals impossible to detect. Cabrillo focused his attention on the topside camera shot of the Petromax supertanker. She rolled ponderously back to an even keel. He continued to watch her for a moment before a smile crossed his lips. There was no explosion from a torpedo slamming into her hull. Max's plan had worked. The wires coiling out from the Kilo to guide her fish had been cut, and the weapons immediately shut down.
"Linda, tell me the instant you hear anything," he ordered.
"Computer is compensating now. Give me another few seconds."
Holly turned in his seat.
"Chairman, the pilot of one of the S-3B Vikings wants to know what just happened."
"Stall him," Juan said, his focus still on Linda, who sat as still as a statue, her right hand clamping the sonar headphones tightly to her head, while in front of her tendrils of light floated down the sonar system's waterfall display.
She finally looked over at him.
"No high-speed props sounds, so the three remaining torpedoes are dead and most likely on their way to the bottom. I hear machinery noises from the Kilo and alarms coming from inside the hull. Wait. Okay, it's pumps and they're blowing ballast."
A bright smile bloomed on her impish face.
"We did it. They're on their way to the surface."
A round of cheers and applause reverberated through the op center, and even Max's bulldog face cracked into a grin.
Nice job, everybody. Especially you, Mr. Murphy, and you too, Max. Tell the team who installed the rocket torpedo and modified the tube to expect a little something extra in their next paychecks.
Although each member of the crew shared in the corporation's profits on a sliding scale, Cabrillo delighted in handing out bonuses for work above and beyond. It was part of the reason he engendered so much loyalty, though mainly that came because he was the best natural leader any of the people under him had ever worked for.
"Look at that!" Eric Stone gasped.
On the main display, he had shifted the camera view to show the spot of ocean where the Kilo had launched its ambush. The water boiled like a maelstrom, and in the center of the disturbance, a blunt object rose from the sea. As the bow of the Iranian sub emerged, they could see her hull plates were buckled, as if she had run full speed into a seamount. The normally convex nose was dimpled in the center, the result of the rocket torpedo exploding 60 yards in front of her. The craft continued to surface, bobbing on waves of her own creation. As it steadied, Stone zoomed the camera in on the damaged hull plates, the Oregon's computer automatically compensating for the ship's motion so the image remained rock steady. Air bubbled up from around the torn metal. Not much, but enough to indicate the Kilo was taking on water. Hatches on her conning tower and her fore and aft decks were thrown open, and a stream of men poured out of the crippled sub.
"You getting anything from them, Holly?" Juan asked.
"General distress calls, sir. Their pumps are barely keeping pace with the flooding. They are requesting assistance from the naval base at Chabahar. Her captain hasn't ordered them to abandon ship, but he wants all unnecessary personnel on deck in case they founder.
Are they asking for help from any ships in the area?"
"Negative, and I doubt they will."
"Agreed. Firing at civilian freighters without warning violates about 50 international treaties."
"And what do you call what we did back at Bandar Abbas?" Max asked, just to tease.
"Petty larceny," Cabrillo dismissed, "punishable by a fine and a couple hours of community service."
Just then, the pair of S-3Bs off the American aircraft carrier streaked over the Oregon and flew less than 100 feet off the surface of the ocean as they roared down the Kilo's length. Sailors dove flat on the decks as the jet wash ripped across their uniforms.
"Chairman, the pilot of the lead Viking still wants to talk to you," Holly said. "And I'm getting an official request from the carrier that we remain in position. It's a Commander Charles Martin aboard the George Washington."
"Pipe it over," Juan said, and settled earphones over his head and adjusted the integrated microphone.
"This is Juan Cabrillo, master of the MV Oregon. What can I do for you, Commander?"
"Captain Cabrillo, we would like to send over a contingent of men to debrief your crew about what just occurred. The captains of the Saga and Aggie Johnston have already agreed. A helicopter can reach you in 20 minutes. The guided missile cruiser Port Royal will be there in 2 hours if you don't have facilities for landing a chopper."
"With all due respect, Commander Martin, none of my crew saw anything. I myself was asleep, and the watchstander on duty is blind in one eye and can't see out of the other."
Martin's voice sharpened.
"Captain, I needn't remind you that coalition forces operating in these waters reserve the right to inspect all shipping entering or leaving the Persian Gulf. I call this a request out of courtesy, but it is an order. You will remain where you are and prepare to be boarded."
Juan understood the pressure the Navy was under to interdict potential terrorists from using the Gulf as a highway for weapons and fighters, but there was no way he was going to let them inspect the Oregon. Corrupt officials in foreign ports could be easily dissuaded from searching the scabrous freighter, but this was not the case with the U.S. military.
"Could you please stand by?" Juan requested.
He covered the mic with his hand and called over to Holly Kasim.
"Get Overholt on the horn. Tell him what's going on and have him get these guys off our back. Eric, set a course bearing 105 degrees and make our speed 18 knots.
He took his hand away from the microphone.
"Sorry about that, Commander.
We can't land a chopper on the Oregon, so you'll have to send a boarding party from the Port Royal.
Very well, Captain. Plan on our arrival at about 1100 hours.
We'll leave the light on for you, Juan drawled, and ended the call. He glanced around the op center. Anyone want a bet?
$20 to the person who guesses the closest. The crew knew immediately what he was referring to.
They'll call back in 10 minutes, Holly opined.
5, Linda said.
They're going to have their hands full for a while. This from Mark Murphy.
He won't notice we're underway for at least a half hour.
I'm with Linda, Eric said. 5 minutes. We'll split the 20.
Juan looked over at Max Hanley.
Care to venture a guess?
Max studied the acoustic tile ceiling for a moment, then leveled his eyes on the chairman. Right about now.
Holy crap, Holly cried. He's right. Martin's hailing us again.
Put him through, Cabrillo ordered.
Captain Cabrillo, consider this your final warning, Commander Martin said. Juan could hear through the clipped speech that the officer's teeth were clenched. If you do not stop immediately, I will order the circling Vikings to open fire on your ship.
Cabrillo didn't doubt Martin's sincerity, but he was also tired of dealing with the man.
Commander, an Iranian submarine just took a pot shot at a fully loaded supertanker. I'm not going to wait around for them to come after us. I will be clear of your interdiction sphere before you arrive, and there isn't much you can do about it.
You will... Martin's voice suddenly cut out. He came back on the line 30 seconds later. Juan couldn't quite place the new tone in his voice. Awe, fear, respect? Some combination of all three?
Captain, you are free to leave the area at your own discretion.
Cabrillo wondered who Langston had gotten to make the call. It had to be the Commander-in-Chief for Naval Operations for the Indian Ocean or one of the Joint Chiefs. Whoever it was nice to have some pull in Washington.
I thought you'd see it our way. Thank you and good luck. By the way, the Iranian kilo's taking on water, so if you want to look inside her, I suggest you hurry. Oregon out.
A meaty hand appeared under Juan's chin. He pulled his wallet from his pant pocket and slapped a $20 bill into Max's palm. Max sniffed the money as though it was a fine cigar. Like taking candy from a baby.
Doesn't surprise me, you know what that feels like.
Cabrillo stood.
Nothing like a little naval battle before breakfast to make you hungry. Navigator, what's our ETA at the rendezvous site?
Not until midnight, Eric replied.
Okay. I want senior staff on watch, so shuffle your schedules as needed. I have to go call Langston, thank him for his help, and then explain why we're only delivering one rocket torpedo.
As he made to leave the op center, he grabbed the 20 from Max's hand.
For costing us that second torpedo, you still owe the corporation $4,999,980.